Hi, and welcome to the Webster University of Geneva podcast. I'm Juliana Sandholm-Bark, founder of Meet the Artist, a public lecture series during which visual artists are invited to talk about their work and their creative process. Last year, I hosted 12 artist lectures and podcasts and organized a few exhibitions as part of this lecture series. And we just started a new season last month, and this is the fourth of 10 episodes we'll be recording until May 2019. For more details about the lineup of speakers, please visit our page through the link wcci.webster.ch/events/meet_the_artist. Our guest today is the visual artist Gilles Duzabet. It's good to have you with us, Gilles.
Thank you, Juliana, to welcome me.
So you gave a fabulous presentation of your work earlier. There was so much to say. I think I wish we were all sort of in the situation where we were wishing that you would speak a bit longer, and then we would have had even more questions for you, but time was limited. But this is the opportunity to sort of comment on what was said and maybe add some more things. How did you first become interested in the world of art? Did you always know you wanted to be a visual artist? This is sort of a question I always start with because I'm curious.
Thank you for the question. Actually, it happened in Figueras. my father was very fan on traveling to Spain. And obviously, as a child, I was very creative. But when I went to the museum of Salvador Dali, one day, and I realized that a museum can be an art piece in itself. And I can felt at that moment, age of 10, the freedom, the extravagancy, the freedom of mind, freedom of expression. I kind of felt at that time that I wanted to become an artist. And I said to my father, Papa, I'm going to be an artist in this lifetime.
And it happened.
It happened.
And here you are. So let's talk about education, because we didn't really talk about education during your lecture, so I just wanted to bring this up. You also work in education, of course. So your education as an artist, could you say a few words about that? Was it, we know that some people are quite critical of art school. We just had a discussion with somebody about how education can kind of corrupt your vision, right, that you bring to the school as a student. So do you agree with that view, or, you know, what do you have to say about that, receiving an education?
Yeah. Well, I went to Chelsea Art School, Glasgow School of Art, went to Japan to study in Royal Academy of Fine Art in Brussels. But my experience in art school is that I didn't remain in one department. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to actually discover from different departments. So I was a little bit like the nomad of the art school. So I was in the textile department, and then I moved to the fine art painting department. I didn't want to define myself as a painter or designer, textile designer. I wanted to just be exposed to different methods, different ways of expression. And that's why I went to public art department, sculpture, architecture. And I was making collaboration with my department, like the painting department and the other department. And I think if you restrain yourself into one discipline at the early age, I think it's not very productive. And then, I mean, it's good to mastering, you know, a medium. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't think it's time to become just a specialist. And especially in contemporary art, you know, now disciplines are not relevant anymore, I feel.
Do you think interdisciplinarity is something that people understand in art school?
Well, in Scandinavia, that's what it is. There's one department. So sound artists, painter, photographer, filmmaker, experimental filmmaker, you know, mm-hmm. they interact and they don't define arts department. But mm-hmm. in UK, for example, they're more into this disciplinary, you know, approach. But I'm much more into one department, and then you can collaborate, you can define yourself within this big mm-hmm. department where transdisciplinary projects mm-hmm. Could happen.
So the question is whether the silos will break down ever in some of these art schools, like in the UK, you know, is that ever likely to change, or is, you know, are things just going to remain compartmentalized?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's interesting because you sort of broke out of the mold and yeah. you're a multidisciplinary artist, you were saying yeah. during your lecture. So, and you've been to many different art programs all around the world. So it's interesting to hear about.
I think it depends what you want to say. I think depend of the concept that you have that leads to a form, a very particular form. Mm-hmm. And that you don't need to have only one discipline to express, you know, and there's more appropriate form or methods to bring into light what you're trying to say, you know. So that's why, you know, my approach to art is very multidisciplinary. Mm-hmm. And I feel that this is the way I fulfill my life as an artist, you know. Mm-hmm.
So this idea that medium follows message, mm-hmm. right? That's, I mean, they're so interconnected, right?
Yes, that's right.
So how did you learn about your own voice as an artist? Because that's the most important thing, right?
By failing, by just trying, by taking a long time to explore so many different way, by walking. I walked a lot. I follow Basho, for example, in Japan for many months. It takes time. I think that's what I was saying earlier, is that it takes a long time to mm-hmm. find yourself and find your own voice. And this is who I am, and yeah, I feel much more comfortable exhibiting right now. It's not forced. It's something that I have within me, mm-hmm. deep inside me, and. And the way that I use a new name since a few years time, mm-hmm. Gilles Dusabe, this is also very important for me. Mm-hmm. The shift where I became like an engaged artist, and that was a very important turnover into my career. Mm-hmm.
I had a question in mind that I forgot now. This is what happens when you have a conversation.
Did I lost you?
Because I got caught up in what you were saying. So now I wanted to go, you know, right. And I wanted to go left sometime just a few seconds ago.
This is healthy.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It keeps you on your toes.
You should keep that. You should keep this moment.
Yeah. I'm really enjoying the moment right now. No, I wanted to ask you if there were certain things that you read. I mean, it's a very artificial question in a way, but in a way, all questions are kind of artificial in the sense that I wanted to ask you, because you've mentioned Japan a few times during your lecture and Japan again a few times now. Uh-huh. So it seems to have marked your experience in a strong way. If you want to talk about how your Japanese experience marked you, your experience as an artist, your voice, or your methods, or your creative process?
I think when I reflect about my years in Japan, first of all, I had the luckiest time to spend, to have a studio in CCAT Kita Kyushu, where I work with amazing curators. And had the chance to meet people like Olaf Eliasson and Roman Ondak or Rikrik Tirivanija. So they are like, you know, like superstar in the contemporary art world. And having feedbacks from them, you know, like was just like a dream. There's two things, I don't know, that comes to my mind, is that one of the things is that I looked at every single book in the library. I really wanted to understand what's was going on since 40, 50 years. And that was to maybe give me a way to position it myself or to at least have a better understanding of what is a contemporary art and modern art. But I think what I gain also from spending time in this residency is how to present, how to curate. And I have now a very minimalistic, I'm very cautious, going to details. Every detail is so important when you exhibit. And I'm a curator myself now, since a few years' time now. But and I'm using this aesthetic of how to actually start an exhibition, which kind of impact you want to give to a viewer from the beginning, from the entry. And which kind of experience you want, which kind of rhythm you want to share. So you want to have some intensity moments and then maybe have like in a work that is a bit more isolated. Everything has its own place. And I think spending time in Japan gave me this minimalistic, essential way of presenting my own work.
Okay. And in the way you present other people's work.
Yeah, now.
I guess, also.
Yeah, now, yeah.
So I'm just thinking of the other question I had for you before, which had to do with your rechristening or rebirth as Gilles Dusabet. Because, so you mentioned that you became an engagé artist, and then you decided to change your name at that time as well. The two things are linked, right?
Yeah, they are.
So who are you before the name change and who are you now? Like, do you really view your life in terms like, you know, before and after?
That's what I was trying to explain earlier, is that before was my artist name was Gilles Gabriel Graciulet. So had a little bit of renown, you know, in the experimental art video kind of scene. I was using Bollex, 16mm film camera, moved to digital. I was doing a lot of photography and got a lot of art relationnel. And then at one point, something happened. I was based in Kigali at that time, so I was working. And then one day, 2013, a bomb in Syria caused 1,400 death, and was gas. You know, it was a gas. You know, like don't remember the name, but and then from that news that I got in Kigali, I couldn't stand it. I was really devastated, and I didn't know what to do. And the only thing that had to become is position it myself and do something about it, and not being silent, not just have another news and just make my life and forget about it. So I decided to make a work reflecting about these innocent people that been dying in these events. And that was when Gilles Dusabet started as a new identity. I took the name of my wife at the time, and then I from now on, I'm reflecting about social issues and issues that talks to me and talks to everyone. And yeah.
But why this need to change your name? Could you not have continued as with the same name?
I think I was in the end of the road, you know, with my former name, my real name. You know, I think I got lost somewhere and I kind of changed my identity. I changed my life, my continent, and I didn't see myself anymore under my former name. So I had to rebirth myself. I have to transform myself into something else. And we call it la mue. In French, it's when the snake is actually changing the skin. And I really...
Shedding skin or...
Yeah, shedding the skin. Yeah, that was necessary. I had to do it. It's something that was essential. So, and yeah, for me at that time.
When you show your work in Kigali, for example, and when you show your work here in Geneva, what is the difference?
Wow.
This is just a small question.
Yeah.
Depends on the work, you're going to tell me. But
well, it's a bit complicated, and I'm not going to use... I'm going to be direct with you. I think we hear much more used to different ways of expression. We have different museum, you have different art galleries, contemporary center, and we much more used to contemporary form of expression. In Kigali, it's a place where the traditions in Rwanda is much more verbal. It's much more through storytelling. It's much more through music and dancing. And the visual art hasn't been really like something very strong culturally, even though there's Imugongo, which is almost only the only visual art form that exists in the country, which is beautiful. It's very graphic. It's quite often black and white, and it's pattern, you know. But a part of that, there is not so much history in the visual art, but the subtlety of the art in terms of music, storytelling, it's amazing. I don't speak Kinyarwanda, but what people tell me, it's very rich. So we're in a context where when I come, maybe I bring an installations and... many years ago, you know, like that was a kind of a new form, you know, of art at the time, and now it's becoming more and more a place where people are expressing themselves in a different way, and there's people from the diaspora coming to Kigali, and also bringing new ways of expression, so it's a little bit more, much more open than before, you know, if I would say. And there's not much difference. I mean, there's people, you know, that are touched deeply and emotionally by different cause and different context, but because my work is very focused on the African and Pan-African context, obviously they are much more engaged, and they know exactly, you know, what I'm talking about. So they're reflecting even their life, you know, and their reflections, you know. Here it's much more broad, so it might talk to some people, it might not talk to some people, so it's you know.
I know you mentioned earlier that you collaborate on projects with locals.
Yes.
In Rwanda, in Kigali, I guess, or maybe other places as well.
Yeah.
Was this a part of your reaching out to the local population and you know, introducing a conversation about visual art in the beginning when you started, or not? You'd collaborated before, and this is just a part of your working process.
This is new, yeah. This is new for me, yeah. Mm. I was making by my own hands before, you know, like every piece that I was doing, and now I'm much more open to consider an art productions not only done by me, and it's a collaborations, and there's friendship, there's a lot of respect, and there's things that I can do, but there's skill that I don't have, so obviously I'm bonding with a community like Embroiderer, for example. So, for example, I have a concept in mind, and then I contact the community, and then it takes quite a lot of time, you know, to make them understand what I do and why I do it. And obviously, every time that I exhibit, then I mention the community itself, you know, so that there is a kind of how shall I say it?
That you're inclusive about
I'm
process.
Inclusive, yeah, I'm inclusive, and I'm proud of it because it's it make me understand better, and I broadened the some craft, you know, quality into my work, and I bringing into another form, another functionality of the work itself, you know, of the the tradition.
What do they think of the result when they see it complete? The it's interesting, no?
It is. When I destroyed 200 sculpture,
my heart kind of screamed when that was happening on screen, I have to say.
And I didn't keep one. I didn't save one. Okay. I made it sure that every sculpture was going to be destroyed. Even though many people say, just keep few and sell it. And I said, no.
The name of the piece again was?
It's the Inevitable.
Inevitable, exactly.
The Inevitable. I think the ceramic people that worked on it found it quite funny, actually.
Really?
They never seen that. And they usually sell, you know, the sculpture. And I was telling them that it was about the genocide, about any kind of genocide. So every sculpture needed to be destroyed so that the people who's going to watch the film will understand the concept and the idea and the unbelievable scene that we usually see in TV, but that was like more an art piece to raise consciousness about and against genocide, you know.
Right. So it's difficult to control, right? You might have the intention, but sometimes the piece gets interpreted in a way that doesn't match your intention.
That's fine. That's great.
You're not you don't get upset or angry.
I know, it is great. When you produce something and you present it, it's not yours anymore.
Right.
So you have a certain attention, and then when it comes to elsewhere, you know, I'm always curious. And no, I'm not upset at all.
You're not attached
happy
to your work.
No, maybe that's extend the work, actually.
Maybe that's when you know you're an artist, is when you can let go of your work.
Yeah, of yourself as well.
Of yourself, yeah.
Yeah, because if you're too egocentric, if you want to be too present in your work, I think that's you can feel. I think the viewer can feel that it's too narcissistic, and I'm fighting well against this way of being, you know, too much present, you know. I think you need to talk about obviously yourself, because this is, you know, but I'm extracting myself as much as possible so that I I have much more compassion. I'm trying to understand others. And that's why I travel so much, to understand myself, but to understand other and other conditions and other ways of thinking, other ways of eating, other ways of kissing, other ways of whatever, you know. Traveling is the best university you can even imagine. And that's why I travel over 70 countries, and I hope to continue the discovery of this amazing world, because it's every step that you do in different country, different land, different culture, it's opportunity to exchange and discuss and debate.
So would you agree with what Alfredo Jarre said when he said 90% research and 10% production?
Yeah, I'm getting there.
Is that something you agree with, to the extent that you actually work like this? Or, I mean, digesting, redigesting, you know, this process of research taking so much more time than the actual production. Is that something you identify with?
Well, not everyone, every artist working this way,
right?
Obviously,
but you.
You know, but I think I'm getting not as him. Probably, I don't know, if I would say a percentage, maybe 70, 65, 35, maybe. But I'm going towards that. I'm really going. I'm spending much more time reading, much more time, and this is time to actually fascinate, construct the substance of what you say or what you want to say or your concept, and the 10%, which is the shape, the object or the installations or the image, that might not take too much time, you know. It's just maybe a few hours or a few weeks or a few months. But I have project that I've wanted to do since years and years and years, but I didn't know how. And it took a long time to actually get into a point where it's like, oh, it has to be done this way. And that's the 10% that represent.
You much of your work has to do with message, or you know, responding to a certain situation of injustice, like your piece on gay rights where you created a shrine. And then you have your really recent work, right, that you're showing now. So there's a big difference in how you... Is there a big difference? I mean, it's a question. The more conceptual, more that you connected with emotions, these sort of colors that were melting into one, into another. So something much more aesthetic, something very pleasing to look at, right? It almost seems like you're working, responding to a current event on the one hand. It's very driven by the message, you know, standing by this hero that touched your life. And on the other hand, we're doing something very conceptual. So how do you explain yourself? But how does this work? It's okay. I mean, it's the way you work, and there's no method, right?
Yeah, but you're trying to put myself into a box.
Yeah, I mean, that's what art historians do. We try, but it doesn't work.
But I don't want to be in a box. I don't want to say I'm a conceptual artist, I'm an aesthetic artist, I'm a narrative artist. I'm just responding into an event, a news, an experience that I really, really want to share, or I really want to bring into light. Bring to an image, to share it and to rise maybe a consciousness, or to make them have an experience for the viewer. But so it could be conceptual, it could be aesthetic, sometime it could be, I don't know, I'm not part of a movement. I just received the picture of the sweet potato recently, and I brought those images into an animation, and I thought about this work actually in Musée d'Ethnographie.
Yeah.
And it's a difficult piece because it took me a long time to decide to eventually deal directly with the Rwandese genocide. And the only way I could was the numerology of the number of days that the 100 days that the genocide happened. And it's unbelievable to think about just 3 months, you know, 3 months. What is it? It's nothing, you know. It's, and one day could be endless. Be endless. So it's the relations to time, you know, that I wanted to, you know, trauma and time and just a lot of suffering, because it's just 100 days, but then can you imagine how many years and how many months that these genocides impacted people. So yeah, it's going to be the first time I'm going to present this work. So so we'll see what the response and if
so this is your vernissage next Friday, right? The 1st of March?
Yeah, the 1st of March. In.
Can you remind us of the gallery?
Well, this is an espace culturel in Ferme Rosset. And there's three floors, so it's quite interesting because I decided to show three different kind of artwork separately. So yeah, the vernissage is going to happen the 1st of March from 5:30 p.m. And the exhibition is from the 1st of March until the 17th of March. And Ferme Rosset is in Troyes. So yeah, you're more than welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for the conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much.